Look up there in the sky. It's a bird, a plane. It's Handsome Boys Comics Hour.
Those boys are so handsome.
Weekly Floppies, this is the part of the show where Eric and I read the week's books, tell you to buy or do not buy them. One weekly discussion of comics and nerd culture. I am your host, Robbie Dorman, literature geek and writer.
And I'm your other host, Eric Z. Goodnight, professional artist and illustration nerd.
We are the Handsome Boys Comics Hour, your home for news, reviews, slightly antagonistic banter, and much, much more. Yeah.
Whoop-de-doo.
Whoop-de-doo.
I was getting anxious there and was about to jump in and do my part and on top of yours. Kind of like I just did right then.
It's fine. It's a Sunday morning. It's cool.
It is a cool Sunday morning.
Literally.
Yeah, it literally is.
Even down way down here, it's still in the 50s.
Yeah. Yeah, it was 48 and I was up and walking around and that is Florida cold.
Yeah, so all you northerners who scoff at our coldness, that's pretty chilly down here.
You just had your Halloween snow.
Yeah. We had our Halloween sweater weather. Uh-oh.
No, not actually. It was like 90 degrees.
At least the
day before Halloween.
Yes, yesterday it was cool.
Yeah.
But we've got a great show for you.
We do.
We're going to talk about Ghost World.
Ooh.
Daniel Klaus.
No ghosts in it. Not really a Halloween story.
No. Not really a Halloween story, but thematically appropriate, I think.
I think so.
We were driving around yesterday and we put on a Halloween quote playlist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all they did was like, oh, is one of the songs was Bad to the Bone by George Thorogood.
Okay.
And I'm like, well, I think their process was like, is there a bone in the title? Okay, it's good. That's fine.
Yeah,
that's a Halloween song.
It's like picked by a search engine or something.
E.T. by Katy Perry was in there.
What?
I don't know. It was not a very Halloween. There were some Halloween songs, like the ones you think of, and then there was E.T. by Katy Perry.
Was Werewolf Bar Mitzvah on it?
It might be. We didn't get to it.
Okay. You ready to talk about some comic books?
Yes. We are switching up our format a little bit, ladies and gents.
Reformatting, as it were.
Reformatting. We're going to start off with Weekly Floppies, then go to Checking In, and then finish up in Nerdboy Book Club, as we are wont to do. But, you know, we're just messing around with it. If you have an opinion one way or the other about how you like us talking to you, like us talking at your faces, let us know. It's always, we like to hear your opinions, but we're going to do it this way because we decided to do it this way.
We did. That is a true statement. Well said, Robbie.
But yeah, with that, we are going to go to the floppiest part of the week.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah, it is time for Weekly Floppies. Weekly Floppies, this is the part of the show where Eric and I read the week's books, tell you to buy or do not buy them. We are going to start. This week, I only did one DC book because literally there's like four books. DC published like five comic books this week and only one of them was even semi-interesting. So we're going to start off with our first indie book of the week. It is Southern Bastards, number 5, written by Jason Aaron, art by Jason Latour. We did not read the first four books in this. I knew a very basic summary of what happened in that first arc. But I picked up pretty much just with context what is happening.
Yeah, it seems to be written to be I think it's the start of a new arc.
Yeah.
And it feels like it's a good jumping on point, it seems like. It does a really good job of introducing you to characters and making you understand the situation. I don't know. It works really well for me.
Yeah, I was a little hesitant about this book when it, and was announced simply because anything involving the South, it can really hit me the wrong way just because I lived here. We live here, and we are both not fans of necessarily Southern culture. If the wrong parts, the bad parts of Southern culture. But this book is it's good, and it's not that bad, the bad stuff. The basic pretense is the coach of the high school football team in this area of Alabama is also basically like a mob boss.
Mm-hmm.
He runs a barbecue stand, but he also, has dirty fingers everywhere and runs the whole area.
Yeah.
And this whole arc is just about him. That's what it seems like it's dialing up. Where he was primarily like the antagonist in that first four issues. And this, he's still not likable necessarily. He's not a good person. I should say that, but I don't know. He has a force of will. And I think that's what it's communicating.
So it starts off with this tub guy who we're going to his funeral in this issue.
Yes.
He seemed like the main character, and it's this radical shift to this Tony Soprano story.
Mm-hmm.
About this grizzled old football coach.
Right.
I really enjoyed reading this because not that I grew up around a bunch of mob bosses, but I certainly grew up around a lot of football coaches.
Yes.
Like my dad was the offensive line coach, and that's where he was most of my life. And all of his friends were teachers and coaches. And I knew all of them, and they walked around the whole town like they owned it. And they were high school football coaches. They still swagger around like they own the damn town.
Yep.
So I really enjoyed reading this. I really identified with it.
Mm-hmm.
I think all the characters are fascinating. I think Alabama may be the only place that I know of. Maybe Alabama and Texas probably take their football more seriously than my crazy ass experience. Oh my God. So I don't know. This is fascinating to me.
No, it's really good. I'm going to go back and I think there's a Humble Bundle not too long ago that had the first arc of this. And I'm going to go back and read them all. But, what do you think about his Jason Latour's art?
I really like it. It manages to take these ordinary looking people and make them look interesting. And it's, it's got the energetic brushwork and the texture that it seems like it's a prerequisite for comic art nowadays. But everything meshes well together. It's simple. Line work done with a lot of energy, probably done digitally, but I can't really vouch for that. And then the simple flat color, it kind of walks the line of not being enough, particularly with the lack of panels, like everything is just sort of off and floating into space,
Mm-hmm.
Had you noticed that? It's pretty invisible, but I think everything is so light. It seems like a smart artistic decision to leave those off of there. Like, I think it would make the page look too heavy. I don't know. That's just a weird thing that I just noticed looking at it again now. But like I said, it does kind of walk the line of just being too simple, but it still carries it really well, tells the story really well.
No, this is a very good comic book. Certainly a buy.
Yeah, it's a hell of a book. This main character is like, if you could take the most grizzled parts of Tommy Lee Jones and mash them together with the most grizzled parts of Clint Eastwood, that's exactly who this coach looks like.
Yeah, yes.
He absolutely looks like both of those guys at once.
Damn, you are grizzled.
Yeah. But solid reference.
The Southern Bastards number 5. We are double buy. Double buy.
There you go.
It's make Eric chuckle.
That's next, what you live for, right?
Yeah, it is. It kind of is. Rasputin number one, written by Alex Grecian, art by Riley Rosmo, colors by Ivan Placentia, letters by Thomas Maurer. So this is a comic book on based on Rasputin, who's by all accounts a monster of history.
Mm-hmm.
Who famously died 8 times? Or got there, you know, there's all that the myths about him, something like that, kept coming back to life.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed this comic book.
I did as well. It's really beautiful and it's intriguing. He's an amazing figure from history, and I'm going to enjoy reading this. I think we need to follow up on more of these.
Yeah, it's at least this first issue is told entirely in flashback, right at the dinner scene where he is ambushed by all his friends and killed. You know. In multiple ways, infamously, but most of it is told as, you know, him and his childhood, and I think the really thing that stands out to me, I think that the writer really lets the art do the talking.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of text and speech in the main chunk of the story, which is told, which is the flashback. And it's really striking, and the art is amazing, so it tells the story really well, and it really works to, I don't know, have this grim, grim setting as his history. And this insane father who is just basically murders people for fun.
I would say he's really my only weak point of this. I'm a little sick of the shitty abusive father trope. But at the same time, I can't imagine. I mean, I don't really know that much about Rasputin, so it might just be absolutely true. But whatever, I don't know. We're gonna see. That's not any reason to not buy this book.
No, it's really wonderful. Honestly, it exceeded my expectations by a lot.
Yeah. Yes. It really, really did. Do you know who this art reminds me of? Oh, gosh, who was the artist for the indie book that was about the guy that drank and got superpowers? Buzzkill.
Oh, yeah.
It definitely reminds me a lot of the art in Buzzkill.
Yeah, it does. I was thinking it's not necessarily in the figures, but it kind of reminds me of Howard Chaykin.
Mm-hmm.
At least in the coloring. I think it's the coloring mainly.
I think that I definitely get that. I think that it is a lot of the combination, you know, and you have the halftones in there and the grittiness, and it's got a lot of that feel, but I think they still combine similarly. Like there's the scratchy line work and the pen work and a lot of similar colors that are used, but it's good like Buzzkill is.
Yes, it is. It's really solid. I'm definitely intrigued. I want to keep reading, and I think that's the best thing a first issue can do.
Yeah, that's its whole job.
Precisely. I'm a buy. Eric, you're a buy.
No, I hate this book that I love.
So, double buy. Recipe number one. Next up, we're jumping over to Marvel. Jumping.
Boing.
Boing. We got Elektra, number 7, written by W. Hayden Blackman, art by Alex Sanchez, colors by Esther Sanz, letters and production by Clayton Cowles. I have been following along with Elektra. I think we read an early issue of this. Maybe even the first one?
It was one of the first ones, if not number one.
Yeah,
I do recall it. It did not look like this.
Yeah, this is the other artist. I think they cycle basically between two artists in this book, back and forth. I've been reading this all along. I've been thoroughly enjoying the series. There's not much that it's Elektra fighting assassins. That's pretty much this comic. I mean, she has been dealing with, other mercenaries and assassin figures throughout the book, and you know all these characters interacting, her trying to save some, protect some, blah, 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 earn her humanity back, I should say. I guess it shares thematically a little bit with Black Widow in that way.
I was going to say, it sounds like the exact same idea as Black Widow.
Yeah, it's just, the setting is, I think, the primary difference, mm-hmm. where that is more of like an espionage feel. This is definitely more of a, I don't know.
This is a kung fu movie.
It kind of is, yeah, with superpowers. But Alex Sanchez's art is not. I prefer what's his name? Del Mundo. I prefer him.
This is. I don't think very good. It feels very rushed and very loose, and a lot of it feels like there's no real sense of shape or form in the faces in particular.
Yeah.
Also in the figures. Like, there's just not enough detail going on. And the colorist looks like they're having to come in and basically rescue this book and make these figures look like humans. I don't particularly enjoy the artwork, and I don't think the story stands on its own merit. It's... If I was more deeply invested into this arc and this was just a break from plot to watch people kill each other, maybe I'd be into it, but it's to me, it's weak story, ugly art, nothing really amazing. It doesn't do it for me.
I was going to say, this is probably the weakest issue so far. Of all the, I've read every single one, and this is, the art certainly doesn't help. Even last issue is the same artist. It was tighter than this.
I mean, and it could be that this person had like a 10-day deadline or something. It's hard to say. Being a professional artist is effing rough. You know, you got to pull things out of your butt sometimes. And I don't know. I'm not super crazy about it.
No, I'm looking at the previous issue right now just to refresh my memory, and it's much more impressive all the way around, like layouts, storytelling, figures, and I think his faces are always going to be, I don't know.
A little wonky.
Yeah, a little wonky.
And that's a stylistic thing, or that's, you know, some people just draw more naive faces.
But I mean, this is not nearly as creative in the layouts, in how the storytelling is. Like, that's pretty much been the hallmark of this series so far, is that, you know, very creative panel layouts, interesting, you know, storytelling with the art. This is the weakest in that regard. I mean, I think the fight scene with Lady Bullseye is interesting just because of her being, like, immaterial. Elektra beating her by breathing her in. I think
it's pretty interesting. Pretty fun solution, I'd say.
But I would not start here. I'm a buy simply because I am buying. I think I'm fairly certain the next issue will be probably back to Del Mundo again, whose art is really what I like the most about this series.
I know you were all about it. We read issue one, and the art didn't sell it to me, and neither did the story. I remember being not exactly really low on it, but it didn't really win me over. And this does not turn that tide.
No, her ditching all the people she's been, you know, she's been meeting up with and having interactions with, the characters, her alone again does not interest me at all.
Right.
So I really, like, they kill Matchmaker. I thought she was a really interesting character. Like, we just lost Lady Bullseye is not nearly as interesting as Kate Crow or Bloody Fangs, I think was the name, who gained power from eating people. Like, those are much more interesting characters than just, you know, Lady Bullseye, but with super special powers.
Right.
So I'm a buy just on the strength of the series, but I would say if you're not invested in this, this is not going to be the one that sells it to you.
Yeah, and I'm just flat out do not buy.
Yeah. So, split decision? I guess.
Sounds like it.
Yeah, what's, I don't know. I want to come up with a better name than that for 1 week.
Splitsville.
Like a bowling alley.
Yeah.
Next up, Inhuman, number 7, written by Charles Soule, art by Pepe Larraz, colors by Richard Eisenhoff, letters by Clayton Cowles. This is, we're catching up with Black Bolt.
Mm-hmm.
Catching up with Maximus. That's what's mainly, and we're kind of seeing that through these two Inhuman cops, basically. Which I think is actually pretty interesting. That we get kind of the Inhuman police force trying to, like, private detectives almost. It plays almost like a noir private detective story.
Mm-hmm.
Mixed with this weird Inhuman soap opera going on. Power play between Maximus and Black Bolt. What'd you think, Aaron?
I enjoyed reading this. It's, I don't know, it's a bit wacky, you know? But it was, I certainly liked it more than Elektra. And I like this this new Inhuman character whose power is apparently he looks weird. That seems to be most of their powers. He's got funny eyes. She's yellow and has ears.
He can generate light.
Well.
And she can find things based on what people say.
Yeah, that's actually pretty cool. His power is he has a flashlight.
Super flashlight.
Well.
He's super flashlight. Get it right.
People really get shafted on these powers.
Well, I think that's what's kind of interesting about the Inhumans to mm-hmm. me. That's why I like them, because their process of getting powers is so unpredictable, and that sometimes, mm-hmm. like, until probably not even until Grant Morrison's run on the X-Men, that we were even. I mean, the 90s, I think some. I think Morrison was the first person really accentuated in the X-Men is the mutants who just looked gross.
Yeah.
Like, we didn't really see much of that. The Morlocks were pretty much the only case of that, and they just mm-hmm. lived in the sewers. But in humans, like, it's a thing. Like, you may win the lottery and become Black Bolt. Like, mm-hmm. look completely normal, be super powerful, or you could just be a ball of goo.
Yep.
You don't even know until it happens.
I always think of the guy from Astonishing X-Men that was like a screaming face inside a torso without a head.
Yeah.
That's God, it's a book worth buying. I enjoyed the first couple of books.
Mm-hmm.
They just were dumb. These are better. God, this whole scene at the beginning where like Maximus takes these women to date rape them.
Yeah.
Made me really uncomfortable. He's like, hey, women, let me just drag you back to this room. How does this taste like a roofie to you?
Well, he doesn't do that. He's a shady, awful person anyway. I'm glad to see Maximus being his mischievous conniving.
Mm. Well, yeah. I always think of him as he sort of walks the line between, you know, good and evil. He wouldn't. I don't see him like. I don't know. That scene made me very uncomfortable. Looking back on it, I can't exactly pinpoint what about it is like really immoral, because nothing's really jumping out. Okay, it's here where he's like clutching at these women.
Well, they're
that's pretty rapey.
They're not like upset at him at this point. They like him at that point. That's before he freaked him out with just a dude sitting in a chair being utterly silent. Here, meet my friend, my brother. He's just hanging out in a room alone.
Dark room. Yeah. Anyway.
No, I'm a buy on this. I like it.
Yeah, it's worth buying. I like what they're doing here. I enjoy this art. Except that Maximus in a red hat looks like Kid Shazam.
He does kind of, yeah.
Yeah, it's weird. It's date rape Kid Shazam.
He has Bart Simpson's lucky red cap on.
He does. Well, he'll wash it and turn your shirt pink. This clearly insane man.
So that's Inhuman number 7. We're double buy. Double buy. Double bye.
All right.
Double bye.
Say everything like that now. It's good.
Next up, we got Batman Eternal number 30, our only DC book of the week.
You can stop talking like a squeaky toy.
Okay. Story by Scott Snyder, James Tynion IV. Script by Ray Fox, Kyle Higgins, and Tim Seeley as consulting writers.
Yeah. Fernando, it took five guys to write this story.
Fernando
Pizarro.
Where
a building collapses.
On pencils. Matt Ryan on inks. Blonde doing the colors. I'm always intrigued by when we see a book colored by Blonde. Mm-hmm. Letters by Steve Wands. Yeah, this is the leading up to the events of what leads to Arkham Manor. So I thought we'd check it out and at least get an idea of why. What happened to Arkham Asylum.
Hmm.
Eric's already spoiled it. The building collapsed.
Well, the last book we read kind of spoiled it for me.
I know. But because of some unholy supernatural thing happening in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
And Justice League Dark plus Batwing is there.
He's there to get pinned under garbage.
Yes. He just, hey, look, my arms are trapped. I'm dying.
Iron Batman is there.
Iron Batman is there. And Joker's daughter is there. Harley Quinn 2.0.
Mm-hmm.
She's kind of like the
Windows 95 of Harley Quinn's.
What do you mean by that?
Well, Harley Quinn is like the Windows XP of Harley Quinn's. Joker's daughter is like the shittier version. She's newer, so she's Windows Vista.
She's Harley Quinn X.
I dislike her.
Yeah, I think I don't know. You have to be a very particular person to enjoy the character of Joker's daughter.
Hmm.
We've been reading this because I don't see the point in a weekly Batman comic written by five people.
Five guys. Five.
Not as good as the burgers. I would rather spend this money on a Five Guys burger.
Mm-hmm. It's not like so horrible it makes me want to pull my own face off or anything.
No, it's a perfectly acceptable generic Batman comic book.
That is exactly what it is.
Which I don't need that in my life, so I'm a do not buy.
Yeah. It'll probably sell 100,000 copies.
This book is selling pretty well.
Yeah.
They just announced a year two of this.
I'm not surprised.
So they're going to do 1 year of this and then another year of weekly Batman comics. So Batman sells.
Yeah, don't buy this book.
That's a Batman Eternal number 30. Double do not buy.
Hey, guess what?
Chicken butt?
I read other comic books.
What?
Or other comic book.
What is that?
I read a Jim's Up book.
Ooh, what one?
Wayward. Number 3.
Oh, right. How was it? I did not read it.
I really dig it.
Is it?
Of course, I'm liking them all progressively more and more.
Okay. Is there any more cutting?
I'm really
in this
curious.
One?
There's no cutting.
Okay.
You can see the scar on her arm. They introduce a new character, and it turns out that there's four of these weird teenagers with powers, and they make a joke about they're going to be a Sentai team or some shit like that, but I don't know. It's interesting. It's a more American storytelling inspired by all this kind of Eastern storytelling, which is, I don't know. There's a lot of that, but I really dig this book.
Cool.
They say things that no Japanese person would say, or at least in my experience. But of course, my experience is mostly manga, anime, and like one novel I read that was translated from Japanese, and they're all sort of told in vernacular. Anyway, Wayward, it's good. I dig it.
Whee! Eric's
a buy.
I am a
buy on Wayward. I do think it's funny that Rory is probably pronounced the same way as Loli,
mm-hmm.
which is like Japanese for like young child girl that tries to, or well, not even tries to seduce. It's pedophile slang for young women.
Yeah, like Lolita.
Yes, exactly like Lolita.
Yeah.
Rory said exactly the same way. It's kind of an unfortunate name. I think they even talk about that at one point, don't they?
It feels like they did. I don't remember.
It seems like they would have to address it.
Yeah, it seems makes sense.
Either that or old Zubby's is too busy trying to compete with Charles Soule and write so many books. He's not doing his research.
It feels like this is a very thoroughly Japanese research book. So it's
I want to say he is, except for he's researching his monsters really well.
Yeah. The supernatural.
Yeah. But I kind of feel, I don't know. It's, I'm going to give him a pass.
With that, Wiki Floppies is over. Hear that? That's the sound of Eric crying.
That is exactly the sound that I make when I cry.
He does not make noises. He does not let anyone know his weakness.
Yep, because patriarchy.
Patriarchy. Down with patriarchy.
I want to cry in public.
Have you seen that thing floating around on Tumblr?
What?
I've already seen it twice in like a day. So it's the boys don't cry. Like, disclaimer, they somehow it links basically that we, you know, because we tell boys not to cry, that it leads to them beating women.
That is the theory.
I'm all for letting people display their emotions regardless of gender. I'm just not necessarily think that that repression necessarily leads to domestic violence. I don't think it's a straight A to B causation.
I imagine that you're wrong on that because women cry all the time and are absolutely never violent.
Never.
Ever, ever, never, ever, ever.
Okay. I am not a scientist.
I kind of agree with you. But okay. At the same time.
Yeah. I agree with the message, not necessarily the content. I don't know.
This is another podcast we're having right now.
It's a different podcast entirely. Yeah. We're going to jump over to check in. Woo!
Woo! I like that we both did that.
I saw a dude in yellow pants yesterday, too.
Did you beat him up and take him?
No, I wanted to stop and ask him where he found his yellow pants, but I think that'd be strange in the parking lot of a Barnes & Noble.
Well, only if you... only if you run over there and like you're breathing heavy, and you're like, where are your yellow pants?
Where did you get those pants?
Good times.
Yeah. Good times. So, I think I'm going to start us off this week.
Are you good?
Yeah. You went first last week. I think it's fair that I start.
Sure.
Sure. Checking in is this part of the show where Eric and I talk about what we went up to during the week.
That's true. That's a factual statement.
So I'm checking in with Campaign Podcast. It's on iTunes under, I think, Campaign or Campaign. I think it's just Campaign. But it is done by the same people who did James D'Amato and Cat Murphy, who do the One Shot Podcast, which I've talked about previously. This is, as the name implies, a RPG real play podcast, but a campaign setting where it's continuing from week to week. And this is
in continuity.
It's set in, it's using Star Wars, Edge of the Empire system. So it's set in the Star Wars universe. These are very talented, RPG people. They know how to DM very well. All the people playing are all, you know, improv / long-term RPG people. So they're all very good at it. Like, they're very funny. Their characters are really interesting.
There's no one in their game like us.
No. Not at all. I mean, they do really dumb things, but it's in character.
Right, right.
And then they actually have, like, repercussions for doing the dumb things sometimes.
As you should be.
They don't just put on mummy costumes and operate like normal.
And I think it's okay. We all won a little bit that day.
I agree. But it's really, really interesting. It's really funny. I think they're 4 episodes in. They come out on Wednesdays. It's about an hour long. It made me want to keep listening. It tells a really interesting story set in this universe. I'm not necessarily a huge Star Wars fan. I love Knights of the Old Republic. Those games were really good. Mm-hmm. And they're set in the Star Wars universe. The movies are kind of... the prequels are terrible. The original trilogy is interesting for what it is, but as an adult, it doesn't, I don't think it holds up as well as it was, as it did when I was a kid. But, it's really fun. Really, and funny. Like, they have a lot of humor in there, which you need. And it's not talking about Chuck Mangione for half an hour like Nerd Poker has devolved into.
Probably a good enough thing.
Yeah. But, yeah, Campaign, it's called just Campaign. Campaign Podcast, I don't know. It's under Campaign in iTunes. So I don't
Seems
know.
Like an odd choice for a title.
Yeah. But the logo says Campaign Podcast, so I don't know. But you search Campaign, you'll find it. The thing I want to talk about is something that I've been playing. Kim has been playing as well. She's the first person. She showed me this. It is a mobile game for your Androids and your iPhones or iPads or tablets called, it's related to Fat Princess, the PS3 game.
Love that game. Never really managed to play it multiplayer too much.
This is called Fat Princess, : Piece of Cake. And it is actually, if you play this enough, you get a certain level, it actually gives you basically a free copy of Fat Princess.
Hmm.
So you can get a free voucher for the
You can get a free Fat Princess.
Yeah, and the game's free to play, at least. I mean, it's a freemium style game. It is it's your Candy Crush, Eric.
Mm-hmm.
It's a match three game. It's kind of like the match three game meets like Castle Crashers, if you played Castle Crashers.
I have not.
It's like you're like a side scrolling beat 'em up kind of game.
Mm-hmm.
But this, you're matching different icons to let different little heroes attack. You're trying to lead the princess to the end of the castle.
Mm-hmm.
And you have bombs, you have swords, you have guns, you have a healer, you get cake and it unleashes the princess. You know, there's a little sub strategy stuff. It's a mastery game. It's a time waster. I would never spend money on it, but it is fun to play. There's RPG elements where you can level up your heroes, and I don't think without that I would not be playing it. But you like just glom on RPG something on any, you know, little time wasting game, and it makes it like 10 times more attractive to me.
Yeah, I can relate to that.
You're like, oh, this game's actually not that. I mean, it's okay game, but then you add in like, oh, I can level things up. Oh, progression.
Yeah, it's been the true peanut butter and chocolate moment in gaming the past couple of years when they decided to start mashing up RPGs and FPSs.
Yeah,
that was but you know, everything else is like, let's put a little bit of FPS in it. Let's put a little bit of RPG in it. Other acronyms. That's how you do it.
But it's available on all your mobile devices. It's fun. It's a time. It is something that, you know, when I'm winding down 15 minutes or, you know, I'm just hanging out waiting for something, I play for a bit, play a level or two. It's very quick levels, maybe 5 minutes. So you can.
When I, you know what I do when I have moments like that?
Read.
I try and experience life.
So in a doctor's office, you experience life?
Yes.
How?
It's called being present.
I'm present. There's a little fat princess. I'm escorting her through a castle. I'm fighting guys. That's imminently more interesting than staring at a crap magazine from 3 months ago. Or worrying about what diseases everyone else is giving me. Just by their presence.
It's all Ebola.
I was not going to go to the Ebola joke, but you had to do it.
Well, of course, Ebola's hilarious.
Yes, it's so funny. I love it that the entire nation is obsessed with something that's not going to bother them at all.
Just like every other thing they're obsessed with.
True. Eric.
Robbie.
What have you been up to this week? What have you been doing?
Not a whole heck of a lot,
you
but
rascal.
I will say that I am a rascal. I'm a wascally wabbit. Speaking of wascally wabbits, I did listen to your recommendation, Sailor Business, and it's helped me to appreciate Sailor Moon a little bit more. Sailor Business is that podcast. I can't even remember. I even talked to them on Twitter a little bit, and I was going to talk about that a little bit. It was.
I know Chris Sims is one of them.
Yeah, Chris Sims is the ISB on Twitter, and the other guy is Crackshot with a zero
Jordan,
on Twitter.
Jordan White.
Right. It's funny. And it's good to see why people enjoy Sailor Moon, and it has helped me to appreciate it. But I do want to tell this this little quick anecdote regarding it. One of the last episodes, it was for an episode that I was just about to watch, so it was one of the first ones I listened to. It was maybe the third episode I listened to.
Mm-hmm.
And they're talking about this episode and this, that, the other, but they go to like a mailbag of weird things that people have sent them and ask them questions. Most of it's fairly standard stuff you would expect people to ask for, you know, a Sailor Moon podcast.
Mm-hmm.
One person apparently tweeted them, "Hey, what if Luna, who is Sailor Moon's little guardian slash conscience slash Jiminy Cricket, but she's a cat, a talking cat. So what if Luna was a scorpion?" They asked them this, and they don't even answer. They just laugh for the longest time. Like, what in the hell? Why would someone send us this? So that night, I pick up my sketchbook and I draw Luna as a scorpion and then tweet it at them. One of them just tweets back, "Ah!" Chris Sims tweets back, "Ah!" And what was his name? Jordan?
Yes.
Jordan actually retweets it. So that's been my interaction with these guys. Anyway, Sailor Business is, I recommend it. It's fun, and it's interesting to hear different people's why they enjoy Sailor Moon. And I'm starting to get it. It's considerably better when all the girls are introduced. It is like Usagi cannot carry that show. I still think she's a terrible character. I think that's kind of part of it. It's a little bit like the Ninja Turtles.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
That, like, girls watching, like, "Oh, I'm like this one. I'm like this one. I like this Sailor Scout." You know? Did we already talk about who was your favorite Ninja Turtle?
It seems like we've had this conversation. I don't know if we've been on
I'm sure
podcast.
We have. I think we have.
I guess what you think, if you don't remember, guess what you think my favorite is.
I think that I like not just your favorite, but your favorite too.
Okay.
And I'm gonna take a stab. I think my gut feeling is that one of your favorites was Raphael. He's either first favorite or second favorite. Am I right on that?
You're correct.
Okay, he's the first favorite.
He is my first favorite.
Okay, he was my first favorite as well.
Okay.
Here's where I'm curious where your second favorite is. I know Leonardo. Normally Leonardo is like, and we should probably cut most of this because I'm going to ramble on about this.
I like talking about Ninja Turtles. I refuse to cut Ninja Turtles talk.
Okay, then. Well, no cutting Ninja Turtles talk. This is a whole other, this is the third podcast that we're starting this time. I want to say Leonardo is at the bottom of your stack, but he's like the Steve Rogers of the group. Which makes me think that you would like him more, but I feel like he's probably your least favorite. So I'm doing process of elimination now.
Okay.
For some reason, it doesn't seem like you would like Michelangelo, but I want to say that he's your number two. I feel like that you might have told me that. Is that correct?
Sorry. Okay. Donatello.
Was it Don? Okay.
Don's number two.
Okay. So was I right about Leonardo? Was he number
Yeah,
three?
He's number four.
Okay.
He's not, I mean, Leonardo, he's, you're right. He is like the Cyclops slash Steve mm-hmm. Rogers of the group, but mm-hmm. yeah. It's Ninja Turtles, so there's not nearly as much nuance there. So
no.
He's on the bottom.
Well, not in the cartoon anyway.
Not in
I think
the cartoon.
It's
I haven't read hardly any of the comics, which I really should do. It's on the list of.
Yeah.
But there's so many. I want to do it justice and actually read it from the beginning.
We'll do some book club TMNT.
Yeah.
My experience with the comics is they're all pretty solid books. I've not read like scads of them, but they're good.
Your number two is Michelangelo?
No.
Who is it?
No,
is it Donatello?
No.
Leonardo? Leo?
It is Leonardo, yeah.
Oh.
So I think it says something about your personality the Ninja Turtles you're drawn to. So I'm the smart ass leader, and you're the smart ass nerd.
Yep. I think that's right. I mean, I like Michelangelo, but I mean, once you get past the fact he likes pizza, what is there?
Yeah, there's nunchucks. I didn't,
that's all there is.
I didn't really care for it. Yeah.
I mean, I like pizza, but it doesn't define me as a person.
Well, I think everyone likes pizza. Only soulless shills don't like pizza. So you want me to check in with something else that's mean and green?
Yeah, mean and green.
Dude, I picked up the She-Hulk book by Charles Soule, however you say his name. But it's... we read the first issue.
Yes.
I don't remember if you cared for it or not, but we certainly did not read any others.
We were both a buy.
Yeah. That's my recollection, because I really dug it. I still love She-Hulk, and the book does not disappoint. It's first five or six issues. It's just... I mean, the stories all relate, and it's not as episodic as all that, but it seems like it's not really one self-contained story. It's a couple of little episodes of different things happening, and, you know, there's a larger story that it just ignores for the most part.
Who's
I don't know.
The artist is Javier Pulido? Is that who's the artist?
There's a couple of different artists, but... and that's kind of a weak point, that there are some artists that I think they look nice, the work that they're doing looks nice, but it's not as it hurts the consistency. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they're right for the book. The sort of weird artistic style of whoever it was, you said
Javier Pulido. I don't know if I'm not 100% on that one, but that's what I recall as the first artist the artist I associate with that book. I'm not sure if that's right though.
It is Pulido.
Okay.
I spelled his name wrong. But I thought it really suited the story. It had a sort of weird and jarring look to it. Like how She-Hulk was weirdly sort of wall-eyed the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
Which I don't know why that is endearing to me. It just sort of was. I liked the covers as well, but it jumped around too much. There were too many different artists doing too many different things. But I like the sort of all red sort of style this guy worked in.
Mm-hmm.
It was a nice looking book while he was on it. But it's good. I recommend you read it. I think you would enjoy it. There's all the stuff that we liked that we may or may not have read all of,
mm-hmm,
is now coming out in trade.
Yeah.
And there's a ton of things that I want to get.
It's
killing me.
Well, pro tip, BarnesandNoble.com right now. Mm-hmm. Buy two, get one free on like almost all the new trades. I bought Miss Marvel, Moon Knight, and I think Captain Marvel. Can't remember. But they're buy two, get one free. So if you're going to buy some anyway, Barnes & Noble is like giving you a third of your purchase back.
Yeah, it's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, it is. I do have some bad news for you, though.
Uh-oh.
In relation to She-Hulk, it is canceled as of issue number 12.
Oh, I was aware of that.
Okay. I didn't know if you knew.
It is bad news, but it is also old news.
Yeah, it happened this week. Early this week, I want to say.
I thought it was a while back.
No. I mean, it's probably been floating around for a while. Because once a book hits a certain number of sales,
mm-hmm,
it's just like, oh, how long until they actually cancel it?
Yeah.
But I think they officially announced it, like, with the most recent solicitations. They said, yep, it's gone. Hopefully Charles Soule will. I mean, he's not hurting for work.
No, he's writing 92 books a month.
Are that it, Eric?
Teenage
Mutant Ninja Turtle podcast talk?
Feel pretty checked in. She's green.
She's green.
She's better than Venus.
Venus?
You don't know Venus. You should Google Venus the Ninja Turtle right now and be horrified.
Venus Ninja Turtle. Oh, what?
She's Poochie.
What? What is this? Why is this exist?
She's Poochie.
She is Poochie.
She's Poochie.
There is some really questionable fan art decisions in that Google image mm-hmm. search. I'm going to close that.
There always are questionable fan art decisions in Google image search for everything, and it makes me really uncomfortable. But that's okay. I'm just happy they're happy.
That is it for checking in with our first mid-episode checking in. It's much like the checking in at the beginning of the show, except it's in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a little bit more turtle talk in this one. We're going to jump into our final segment of the week. It is time for Nerd Boy Book Club. Nerd Boy Book Club is the part of the show where Eric and I will assign, quote-unquote, a longer collected work and discuss it. Its themes, art, everything in more detail than general, like you would in a book club. Crazy.
Mm, it's just mind-blowing.
Bonkers.
Bankers.
I don't know if bankers would enjoy this. Probably depends.
Gotta do something.
Depends on the banker. But this week, we are doing Ghost World by Daniel Clowes. Critically acclaimed, made into a movie, starring Scarlett Johansson and that actress whose parents ruined her life. Thora Birch.
Which one is she?
Thora Birch. She plays Enid.
Scarlett Johansson, it looks like he's almost trying to draw Scarlett Johansson in this book.
Yeah, it's odd. I mean, that's good casting because...
No, it's pretty damned good casting. It's kind of shocking. This is a weird goddamn book.
It is a very strange comic book. How would you describe this comic book, Eric? Give me your plot synopsis. I like the Eric Goodnight plot synopsis.
Well, you open a book and it's got the 90s all over it. That's this book.
It is very 90s.
It is the most 90s. And I think it really says a lot. I don't know. Young people at that time and how people sort of felt and couldn't articulate things. Like, I feel like a lot of people would have felt like they had no agency, the way that all the characters seem to just feel frustrated and empty, and they're going around doing dumb shit like this. I feel like most people nowadays would feel the same, except without the outlet of social media and the internet. I think we, you know, there but the grace of God, go I. I don't know. It's weird and frustrating to read this.
Yeah, it really, I mean, that's, I think, what most people, the, you know, critical response was that, I think it varied in between, wow, this really captures what it's like to be a teenager in this time mm-hmm. of your life, or, wow, yes. This is really pretentious and I hate it, but.
I don't know that I'd call it really pretentious. I think that but I don't see it as pretentious, not really, but I can clearly see that there's an audience of people that I'm positive are really gonna strongly identify with this. But it kind of churns my stomach to read it. I don't know that it doesn't not work for me. I think it is. It's doing exactly what it wants to. So it's just, I don't have whatever it is that this speaks to.
Mm-hmm.
I've got some other sort of neurosis. This doesn't speak to mine.
From what I've read, Enid is basically just, it's Daniel Clowes talking, like it's basically mm-hmm. him. The name is, Enid Coleslaw is an anagram of Daniel Clowes.
Yeah.
And I've read what somewhere else that he made them two female teenagers.
Yeah.
So that they could say more ridiculous things and not, there wouldn't be as much criticism.
Yes.
Like they're allowed to, you know.
They're allowed to say cunt.
Yes.
Which they do.
Yes.
And they say, well, they don't say it like a lot, but they do just drop it.
Yeah. In various racial slurs.
They don't use racial slurs.
They use the word Jap.
They, oh God. Yeah. They say Jap constantly, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
That did make me really uncomfortable.
What?
All I could think was, Jesus Christ, people were really racist in the 90s.
Well,
people are still racist as fuck now, but still.
Yes, they are. But I think you talked about that this book, I think, is designed to make you feel a little bit uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
You're not?
Yeah.
It's supposed to be like, it's a very kind of close look at these two teenage girls, and they've just graduated high school, basically. Mm-hmm. It's the summer after they've graduated.
Yeah.
I think we've been led to believe. And I think it really paints a portrait of what life, I know it, my life was like.
Yeah.
After I graduated high school, like, oh, well, what do I do now? Oh, I'm going to college because that's what you do, I guess.
I never really had that sort of oh shit moment of that. It never occurred to me that I wouldn't go to college. I don't know. I guess that's, I didn't even think about it. Well, I barely even made a decision about going to college. It's like, well, I'm going to pick this college out of a hat and then go to it. That's the kind of idiot that I was.
Well, that's the same thing. I didn't really have much. And that's, I think that's also kind of a focus of this.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it brought up in me was, you know, we look at these two girls and they're both, you know, confused.
Yeah.
Socially clearly. Awkward.
Yeah.
You know, are struggling with life and themselves. And now they have to decide what they're, you know, quote unquote, decide a direction for their life.
Mm-hmm.
When they don't even know what to do with them. Like, and I think that's part of that pressure is like, you just kind of go, I'll do this because it's what the other choice is there.
Yeah.
And their friendship, I think, is a friendship of that everyone kind of has this, you know, you have a best friend in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And then you graduate and now you're not stuck together. Now you can go anywhere you want. And oftentimes they vanish. Or they go do something else, you do something else, and you're not really, you're still friends, but you're not friends. And this is the 90s, so there really wasn't Facebook or anything like that.
Yeah.
So.
Just people just sort of disappear forever.
Yeah, you never see them again. Or you lose, you know, you will talk to them once a year.
You know what this kind of reminds me of is Superbad.
Yeah.
It's almost the same premise.
Yeah, yes. Well, or vice versa.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think they're in love with each other?
I
mean, they're very affectionate with each other. They're kind of they argue like a kind of an old married couple.
Right.
And both of them just sort of casually are like, yeah, maybe I should be a lesbian. They say lesbo.
Yeah. I don't think
so. Who
should
be a lesbo?
I don't think so.
I don't know. It's.
I was never a teenage girl, but. Being a teenage boy and knowing that, you know, I had conversations about mm-hmm. life and all that stuff when I was a teenager, and I was just about as stupid. And as a dude, you're basically like hardwired not to like let yourself be physically close to other men.
Yeah,
like you're not allowed because that means you're gay mm-hmm. and
because
evil.
Patriarchy.
Yes. Patriarchy, but I don't. I always got the impression that women or girls never got the you can be physically affected.
Oh no,
yeah,
is. I definitely get that, but it's such a recurring motif. I want to say that Enid says it at least twice, and God, what's her? I can't. She doesn't have a weird name, so I don't remember it.
Rebecca.
Rebecca. See, it's such a normal name.
Doppelmeyer. I just remember the Doppelmeyer, the doppelganger. Yeah.
Yeah. She says it one time. Enid, I think, says it at least twice.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's like the major relationship in either one of their lives.
Yeah.
And it's them parting at the end. I mean, it's really the sad and crushing moment for both of them.
Yeah.
Whether or not, you know, they've made some decision to whatever, go their separate ways, be straight, whatever. It's still really crushing because whatever the case is, they're still the biggest thing in each other's lives. That was kind of the thing that I really liked about Superbad. that it's this movie about these dumb high school boys trying to party and get laid, and at the end they spend the night with each other, and they're like, "I love you, man."
Yeah, that is the kind of happy ending version of this similar story.
Yeah,
this is the other way where, you know, they just kind of split.
Yeah,
I think that's speaks to the book, that you can read that relationship into it, but it's not explicit.
Yeah, and I don't necessarily think it would be better if it was. Like, I like the ambiguity there, that you think that, you know, there's no way. I think that it's pretty important that it be this. You know, that they have, I like it ambiguous, you know.
Well, yeah, I think that their relationship is deeper than that. I think that their connection is, I think the fact that they, I think it, the way that they both are experiencing their trouble with boys, and like not able to find anyone, they both kind of at different points want a relationship with Josh, and their weird ways they look at all the other dudes around. I think it seems like they, it's hard to say. It is very ambiguous. But I think that's to the credit of the story and the fact, I think if leaving it ambiguous is more impactful at the end than if it was just explicit. Like, this is what they are. This is what their relationship is. I don't think they know what their relationship is. And I think that's what makes it so crushing at the end, is because they never define it, but it obviously is the most important thing in their lives. And it just vanishes. I think that a lot of this book is dealing with them trying to define their relationship, especially when Enid's talking about going away to school, and you know, she invites Rebecca to drive with her, and then Rebecca's like, maybe I'll just move there with you, and they don't know, and you know, they're constantly waffling back and forth about what they want. But that's what teenagers do. They don't even know what they want, and even if they do know what they want, they don't know to say it or how to say it or how to interact with people. At least I was when I was a teenager.
A lot of being a teenager is being too dumb to articulate anything that you want or need, and sort of becoming a moody, depressed fuck because of that.
Yeah.
I definitely relate to that, but I feel like everyone, I guess that's me being, cause I'm a couple of years younger than Enid says she is. And you're not a whole lot younger than me, so you probably remember the 90s roughly the same way I do.
Yes.
Roughly. So I guess maybe like I'm just coloring it with my experience, but it felt like a lot of people, certainly a lot of culture, was giving the same message. You know, they were desperately trying to find something and not finding it. There's a lot about what grunge was about, and a lot of like indie music and indie movies, or they called it alternative then. Everybody trying to find something.
Yeah, I mean, it made me all this. There's a whole like a strew of 90s movies that were similar in at least theme, in you know, cynicism, being young and cynical and not knowing what to do with your life, and
yeah,
all that. What do you think about, we haven't discussed Daniel, his art at all. What do you think about it?
It's well drawn. It's not, you remember we discussed the concept of appeal?
Yes.
Of how you compare, say, you know, Disney art. I think the examples we use were Frozen versus Steve Dillon.
Right.
You know, of Preacher. This falls more on the Steve Dillon end. And I kind of think a lot of 90s stuff, because Preacher was Preacher's very 90s, that it was almost like rejecting appeal as a matter of fact. And this is, it's not drawn in an appealing way, it's drawn well. Everyone looks ugly, even if they're supposed to be nice looking, and it's still drawn well. It's just drawn ugly. I don't understand why like everything, all these little underground comics in the 90s were colored this way.
With the blue?
Like one color, blue.
It's
really strange.
He has said that he chose the blue because he wanted to, he wanted to reflect the experience of walking home in the twilight when every house has a television on and the living rooms are bathed in a ghostly blue light.
That is the most pretentious horse shit I've ever heard. That is fucking troubling. If one of my friends did a comic, I mean, if one of my friends did this comic, I'd be like, you know, great job. This is a nice work of art, and you've done something really good. But if they turned around and said that to me, I would fucking punch them in the arm. Don't ever say something like that to me, Robbie. I'll punch you in the armpit.
Well, I didn't want to say anything, but I just drew an entire comic book.
while we were on Skype.
In this podcast, I've drawn an entire comic book.
I thought you were a little distracted. That's pretty good.
I didn't use blue. I used green.
Okay.
Because I wanted to, it reminded me of Slimer from Ghostbusters.
See that? I won't punch you for that. Okay. That's not pretentious.
Slimer.
Jesus Christ, that is the worst thing I've ever heard. But like everybody did this. Like Allred did it in some of the early Mad Men, and Bob Fingerman did it. Several of these other guys, like it was like a big thing. Like, don't just make your comic black and white, let's put blue in it. What the hell, guys? It doesn't make sense. But I feel like a lot of books are just comfortable being in black and white now. It's weird that this was the motif at the time. And I really question if there were any practical reasons for doing it. Like, does it cost? I mean, you're talking about printing something in two colors versus one color. You know, and certainly it's different than printing it in full four color process and the expense involved in doing that. I'm really curious what practical reasons there are as opposed to pretentious reasons.
I don't know. There is an interesting part here about how the comics, when they originally appeared in 8-Ball, which is, I guess, was a, you know, had a collection of comics.
Yeah.
They were, like, early chapters were black and dark blue, and then black and lighter blue, black and light green. Apparently, they made them all the same for the collection.
The collection.
Yeah. And apparently, he redrew a few panels for the collection as well. Nothing really, doesn't really read anything like it's, in, like, very important. I guess it was just kind of his... You give artists enough time, he'll just work forever, I guess. I think that's what a lot of people...
That's really true. The what they say is there's no piece of art's ever finished. It's only abandoned. And I just picked up two old pieces of art on my computer and did new versions of them for no good reason other than they were there.
Yeah.
And I thought I wanted to do it.
And I think that's the only reason he just was like, I like it different now. I'm going to change it. So he had a chance, so he did it. But
all of a sudden, you got walkie-talkies in E.T.
I can't find any reasons besides the pretentious ones.
It just sort of hurts to read it. You know, it's unappealing, and it's meant to be unappealing, and ugly realities of being a young person and life.
Yeah.
It's tough, I think.
What do you make of all the weirdos in this?
It feels like everyone is a real actual person that this guy's met.
I think so, yeah.
It feels too on the nose. I've met too many insane mo's that are at least this strange. But it's really odd. I don't know. My experience as a teenager, I felt like, and maybe it's just from being such a small town. Like I had to move off and go to college and to have these experiences. There were not, I wasn't meeting child pornographers and Satanists until, you know, I was much older.
Yeah, that's
the guy really looks just like Anton LaVey.
Yeah, he really does. Like, that's why everyone's like, wow, that's Anton LaVey.
Yeah.
That's the thing. I think that's the one thing that is, like, this book is very relatable to me as a teenager. Like, as my teenage memories, like, their experience. But not, I grew up in a relatively small town. And mm-hmm. I did not run into any child pornographers or Satanists or, like, I that's the thing that took me out of it, out of the book.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not that it's not entertaining. They're interesting characters, how weird they are. But, like you said, it's when, like, you get older and you, like, they seem too young to be so immersed in this world of zines and records and to know, like, these people so intimately. Like,
yeah.
It's just, it's strange to me.
Well, it just says, to me, every aspect of this book, I'm going to keep coming back to it. It's this whole 90s movement of, like, trying to look at the ugly alternative parts of life. Go to the independent record store and talk to the guy that makes a zine and is friends with a child pornographer. It feels exactly like, I don't know. It's a reactionary movement. And even to this day, I know people that are like this. I don't know what they're rebelling against. It's the punk rock kids.
Yeah. In retrospect, it just seems kind of silly.
It does.
I mean, I think the core relationship between Edith and Rebecca and how all their experiences is still relevant.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, like, the fact that, you know, they drive really far on a bus to go to a weird diner just because they're bored.
Yeah.
Like, I did that, or I did similar things when I was a teenager.
I do that every weekend.
So it's, I don't, do you think that all that weird stuff weakens? Like, if you read this book 50 years from now, when the 90s are just like an abstract concept,
mm-hmm.
do you think that this book will be as, like, do you think the story can be as, do you think that weirdness dates it?
Yeah. I mean, it definitely does date it,
yeah.
But the same way that, you know, putting stuff in a time capsule and then looking at it, it's the same thing. This is like it is very dated. It is very much these movements. I mean, it's to say it doesn't age well mm-hmm. is kind of the opposite. This is like a perfect snapshot of so many of the emotions and just the feelings that certainly I was having at the time. I feel like the larger part of culture was having then.
Yeah.
It was a reaction to a lot of different things, and I don't know. I feel better having read it, but I don't know. I kind of want to take a shower now. Something about it just doesn't sit quite right with me.
Well, I think it's, I don't know. We talk a lot about the current comics, where the ones that use social media as like a huge storytelling mm-hmm. point, and how like
mm-hmm.
things are going to look ridiculous, or like this is dumb and this isn't how it really is. And in 10 years, it's going to be entirely different. It's going to date this book.
I do say that a lot, but I think the difference is this is accurately really capturing. It's really capturing that time period. It's really, it captures the 90s.
Right.
Where putting social media in your book is going to make you look like a sad old man trying to appeal to the kids.
It would require, we just haven't really written that. Well, Batgirl wasn't bad. Batgirl did it.
Batgirl was not bad. Batgirl might actually say something about this time period and what people are thinking and feeling.
Right.
I think Batgirl's a pretty good example. You know, that people are, you know, they're trying to stick up for feminism and they got this stupid social media and this little twee hipster culture. I think it says a lot about, you know, the stuff that people are going through now in the same way that this does. It's, you know, I don't want to say it's not as arty, but it's certainly not as indie.
It's not as indie.
Yeah.
That's true. Do you think Enid or Rebecca are you find them likable protagonists?
That's a good question. I don't think they are, but they seem like the kind of people that will grow into being good, likable people. When you're like a teenager, I don't know. It's like you're on a midway point between being a child and being a halfway decent person. It's so much about finding yourself that you're just kind of awful and deplorable. I mean, I think it's very easy to have empathy for them.
Yeah.
They're very empathetic characters. I don't know that I like either one of them. They do a bunch of really bad things in this book, but they're stupid and young, and they have no, I mean, clearly, like, when they call that guy who has the want ad, the really sad misconnection, and he shows up, and they just sort of laugh at him, and then think about it a little bit, and then feel shitty. It's like, it's clear in many occasions in this book that they are kind of wrestling with the idea that their actions affect other people. They just have no idea. Like, it's just completely, there's no connection between causality with them, you know?
Yeah.
They call the guy that looks like Don Knotts and make fun of him on the phone, and we're led to believe that he kills himself for up until he shows up again at the end of the book, and little things like that, you know, how they kind of mess with this boy character that they're both interested in. And I don't know. They're not meant to be likable.
Right.
But, you know,
I agree with you. I don't think they're likable, but they are, you're right. Mm-hmm. You empathize with them.
Teenagers are and have been in our culture a pretty universally hated and feared group of people. I think teenage girls less so, because we're very comfortable sexualizing them and, you know, just ignoring the fact that they're humans with personalities, which this does not overly sexualize any of them.
No.
And it gives them really flawed personalities.
But honest ones.
Yeah, they're honest. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with a flawed character. It just makes them richer characters.
Yes.
They read more like teenage boys. You know?
Well,
like, this is a story.
The fact that Enid
is
based on Klaus himself.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I'm saying. It reads more like a story about teenage boys. But at the end, it doesn't. That's not me saying that it's inauthentic, that it's badly written, or I don't buy that it's a book about two girls. But this is more the shape of a story. These are more characters that it seems like this should be a story about boys. And I kind of like that it's about these two girls because of that. You know, it's a better thing, I think, to tell a story about two flawed women than the same story about two flawed men. It seems, certainly for a male writer, like a more challenging thing to write, and it, I think, ends up being more interesting.
Yeah, I agree.
Her dad is, like, the nicest guy.
He is. When he leaves that record out for her, he finds that record that she's looking for, and when she comes back upset, and, like, that's...
And she hugs it, yeah. It was right after she, like, went and tried to fuck this guy.
Well, she... That's a
no.
A very upsetting. That was, I think, the thing that made me like go. Oh, I may not like her, but she's.
Oh yeah.
In trouble.
It felt pretty real.
Yeah. Who would you recommend this book to?
Females.
That's it.
That is half the people on Earth.
52%.
I need to. Yeah. I I mean, I guess it really depends on how into your taste is. I can think of many people, a lot of people that would enjoy the Fingerman stories, that would enjoy weird stuff like the auteur.
Mm-hmm.
But I would feel comfortable most of the women in my life recommending this to them. I think it would probably speak to them. Probably specifically the ones that are about my age. You know,
yeah, 90s kids anyone who grew up in the 90s. This is kind of that.
It would really speak to them. Yeah. People that know who Janine Garofalo is.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah, I don't think you can suggest this comic to like an average superhero fan, but anyone who's open minded and like if you like Superbad, I can't imagine you not. I think you could if you say, "Hey, do you like that movie? This is like the same movie but with girls."
Yeah,
same story, shape. Mm-hmm. Well, to be fair, Superbad is imitating this more than because this came out like.
Yeah, I don't think that they time traveled and ripped off Superbad.
No. Superbad's a little bit more lighter, though. It's certainly not as heavy.
Yeah,
but
it's this told in a more appealing Judd Apatow style.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Have you seen the movie of this?
I have not. I have never seen it.
It's different, but it's good.
Does the story lay out any differently?
It's rough. I mean, a little bit, just because they fill a whole movie, and the male characters play a slightly larger part.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's roughly, I mean, it's telling a similar story.
I do think it's interesting that he's drawn them cuter on the front and back covers than they are in the book.
Yes.
Got to get some appeal on the cover.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's make it less appealing in the book. I think it's interesting that it hangs together so well, considering the episodic way the story was told.
Yeah. I think he's a good storyteller in it. And it keeps moving. It never stands still. Like, there's a lot of text, but it's not necessarily all. It's moving. It's pace. The pace is quick for what it is. So, folks, that was Ghost World by Daniel Klaus. Next up. Next week, Nerdboy Book Club, Black Sad by Juan Diaz-Canales and Juanjo Guarnido. I apologize if I pronounced those names incorrectly.
No, that was exactly correct.
Exactly correct.
Perfect micro inflections.
Yeah, right. Funny. But yeah, Black Sad. I'm a kitty cat private eye. That's what it's about, right, Eric? Kitty cat?
Yes. And it's, yeah, it's it's kitty kitty.
Yeah, it's a 50s noir story told with animal characters.
Mm-hmm.
I'm excited. I'm quite interested. The art looks really nice.
I'm definitely looking forward to reading it. It's beautiful.
Yeah. But, I think that'll bring us to a close. We are the Handsome Boys Comics Hour. You can find us at handsomeboyscomicshour.com. You can find us on iTunes. Please subscribe, rate, review. Do all those things there. It really helps us out. More reviews, more subscribers get us more listeners. We really appreciate every single person who does that for us. You can also find us on Facebook, facebook.com/HandsomeBoysComicsHour. Twitter, at HBCHour. Tweet at us there. You can find us on, I think we're on Tumblr. Remember to update it. You can email us at handsomeboyscomics@gmail.com. I will definitely reply.
You better.
I will. You can find me, myself and I, on Twitter at MixmasterCereal. It's MixmasterCereal. Eric, where can they find you online?
You can see my portfolio by going to freewillunlimited.com. And you can see my newly updated ericzgoodnight.com, where you can check up on all the things I do on the greater internets.
It's pretty handsome.
I feel pretty good about it. It's a nice piece of art I have up there. One of my favorite little things that I've done. You can also tweet at me. Twitter handle is Mr. Bad Example. Spelled MR Bad Example. Woo.
Woo. So with that, we'll bring this episode to a close. Have a good one.
Rock and roll.